Alright, so it doesn't even matter what I call this one, because I changed the name a bunch of times. I initially called it Schism, after the papal schism and the decline of the empire. That's roughly what's happening, but you're also going to see the Christian doctrine of individualism show up. You're going to see nationalism on the rise, and all that's going to be happening at the same time. In fact, I have as a big idea here, the civilized world was being built up on a Christendom that was being pulled apart. So how do I graphically demonstrate that? Well, you have the idea of the Holy Roman Empire, which was none of the three, attempting to be all of them. But this is kind of diffusing for a lot of reasons that we've already covered. And really, what we're talking about today is the last nails in the same coffin. And it's sort of diffusing, splintering, from a sociological perspective, largely because of the rise of nationalism. Independent nation states. So I'll just represent that. That's what's going to make up the next chapter of history. And there's other things going on there that I suppose sociologists wouldn't give as much credit to. Christian doctrines, or maybe doctrines that they would see as products of the Renaissance, or maybe products of the Enlightenment. And there, let's just put this one in parentheses, I'm speaking specifically of individualism. And that ism is always a tricky word. So we really have to look at all these things going on together. There is one more that I would put there that many Christians wouldn't even. So I'll put a double parentheses. A philosophical movement that we touched on last week called nominalism at the close of the medieval era. And you'll see why all of that. I'm not going to draw an arrow from this to this because I'm going to treat individualism, at least the Christian idea of it, as a good thing. And so you're going to have this mixture of good things and bad things and indifferent things and natural things and spiritual things, all in the providence of God here. So it can look like a jumbled board at first, unless you're coming from a Christian perspective. From a Christian perspective, it makes sense that all these things are going on at the same time. From a Catholic perspective, one historian says, church law, or canon law, has arisen from this overpowering desire of the natural man for a legally constituted, Catholicized church. So a church that presides over and directs all of the affairs of secular society. And no one personified this tendency more than one Benedict Giottani, or as history knows him as, Pope Boniface VIII. And we mentioned him in passing last time, too. But he was definitely a bad dude. I mean, he was one of those people that I think all parties can agree he was bad, just like all parties can agree that Gregory was a good pope. So all parties would agree that Boniface was not only a bad pope, but a bad human from all accounts. He was 80 by the time he ascended to the papacy, but his age did not prevent him from being strong-willed. Boniface ruled from 1294 to 1303, and in a lot of ways, our timeline here is going to move us from around this time. And I'm going to intrude, and we've done this before, where we've overlapped the same time from week to week, but covering different subjects. And that's kind of going to happen this time as well. We're going to go all the way to 1415 in a council called the Council of Constance. Now, I realize that in there you have the story of Wycliffe and Huss, but we're going to wait for next week, the final week, to talk about them. We're just talking about the big picture of what was going on. If they had CNN at that time, this week is going to be covering what would have been going on CNN, and a little bit would be going on C-SPAN, maybe. But we wouldn't be covering, but Huss and Wycliffe, that wouldn't show, Wycliffe would, but Huss wouldn't necessarily show up on the radar screen until a couple generations after. So, Boniface. He pretty much, by the way, when he was first elected, there was a false rumor going around that he had died just a couple days later, and the streets were dancing with people, from Italy, from everywhere, from his home and from people abroad. So he was hated before he became pope. But he really brought the secular aspirations of the Roman Church to its peak. He spent his days attempting to strong-arm the French and the German monarchs, not realizing that those days were gone. That had been done before, but by Boniface's time, he was really holding on to a past view. The nobility and their theological servants spared no expense, from France and Germany, I mean, no expense in charging him with all manner of heresy and license. The Pope's arch-nemesis across the Alps was the French king, Philip IV, or, last good medieval name for you, Philip the Fair. Yeah. And he actually wasn't any more fair than Boniface was. He was also very ambitious. And more than the German or the English king, he really intentionally tried to stick it to the Pope. These other guys, they were just drawing away by inertia. These nations were getting bigger and more independent, but the French king really had designs on the papacy and all of Europe. And as I said, the Germans didn't fare as well. Their king, Albrecht, assented to the right of Boniface to elect whomever he willed. And then there were the English, who led by Edward I, who clearly told the Pope to stay away from anything surrounded by water. And that, we would see, was Edward was very strong about that, but really the English king didn't have to say that as much, because they were a little bit more isolated. Calling him the Prince of Modern Pharisees, Dante, in his Inferno, reserves a special place in the inner circle of hell for this infamous pope, as he says, quote, quivering in air, his tortured feet were seen. This is during that time. Or as it was said among the people, he came in like a fox, he reigned like a lion, and he died like a dog. Well, we'll come back to the, yeah, he was loved. He was it's like a Shakespearean sonnet on a Hallmark card to the Pope. I don't know, but it was in the popular esteem. And he had very few defenders, and only a handful of very backward types in Rome after that tried to even defend what he was saying. And that's one of the more interesting things about Catholic history and their doctrine of papal infallibility is, who do you justify it and why? And if you don't justify people's moral behavior, their statements universally, on what ground do you do that? You say, well, he's speaking ex cathedra over here, but not over here. It becomes really hard to do that when some popes are outright heretics or complete villains. But anyway, we'll come back to this arrogant man who seemed to define the whole age. We have to talk a little bit about doctrine first, because it's been brewing ever since the early Middle Ages to this point. The main thing that Christians have always misunderstood about their own faith is that it is a worldview of being the worldview. One of the cardinal doctrines of Christianity is that it's right about everything. And on paper, everybody, oh yeah, sure, I know that already. But when you really break it down and talk about the implications of that, it becomes very, very uncomfortable for especially post-evangelical Christians today to admit such a thing. Christians will say they understand the truth, that all truth is God's truth, but we betray it with 1,000 reductionisms. And this was even the case in the Middle Ages, and it's the case today. It's even the case among postmodern types who will say, they'll say what looks like the same thing at first about Christian arrogance. For example, they'll castigate Christians of the past for supposing that they have a final picture and a totalizing object of our vantage point that we call Christianity or orthodoxy or simply the truth. In fact, sometimes you can even find conservative Presbyterian types writing books today called, for example, Against Christianity, saying things in the opening pages like, Jesus never started a movement of an organized religion called Christianity. Christianity is not in the Bible. Christianity, or orthodoxy, was, in a sense, a power play, something that emerged subjectively later on. And so the idea is, you can't have a final totalizing picture of everything, as if that's what a systematic theology is. There's always more to our faith. But it never occurs to the postmodern critic to ask why there's always more, and more to what. I mean, this is just a short step on the way to agreeing that Christianity, whatever else it is claiming to be the truth about all things. The medieval synthesis that we looked at last week was not guilty of being a system. Probably its greatest sin was that it was dead on arrival. Maybe its thinkers were just getting started. So, for example, sometimes you say, well, why didn't Augustine or Aquinas have a large section on evidential apologetics or existential apologetics? I can give you two reasons. There was a spear shoved in their back. And people typically don't write very well or straight when they're running from a Muslim. That's just one thing. I can then go to the Black Death and things like that, and so on and so on and so forth. Maybe the worst sin of all was that they were just getting started, as all finite thinkers must. It's difficult enough to write a whole book in the prime of life and in the middle of affluence, with the wonders of technology at our fingertips. But it's another thing altogether to build an entire synthesis of the one true view of everything in the middle of social chaos and in squalid living conditions. Is it at all possible that we've judged the medieval Christian mind by standards that bear no resemblance to the reality of the situation? That's a rhetorical question. The answer is that's exactly what we've done. Take one example. Let's return to the question of the fall of the Roman Empire. One medieval historian speaks of the, quote, Christian answer of Augustine in contradistinction to the moral answer, the rationalist answer, the political answer, the social answer, the economic answer, the pathological answer, the genetic racial answer, or the biological, or the cynical, or the mystical answers. These are all different possible interpretations of why Rome fell. These are all posed as competing explanations for Roman decline, as if their respective objects must operate somewhat independently of each other. If there's a unity to these diverse explanations, it's subtly suggested by the historian, that we can get to work on it starting now. We can finally see, in retrospect, what Augustine and those guys couldn't see, the whole picture. But the true Christian explanation encompasses all of these. No other view can claim this unity, and there's nothing in the Christian worldview that cannot explain the best of all of those vantage points in all of their diversity without disintegrating their unity. In fact, the Christian would say that none of these make total sense without the unity that Augustine's medieval picture did provide. We've also seen, hopefully, that civilization matters. Here's two extremes. Civilization matters not to the truth of Christianity, but through the truth of Christianity. The truth of the gospel itself does the work of the Spirit with or without the help of civilization. But to say that its civilizing manifestations don't matter is as romantic of a secularism as the idolatries of nationalism and radicalism that are going to start to show up in church history at this point. And we see this ironic cynicism everywhere today in people that are pietistic, that separate elements of the gospel from elements of society or thinking. So, for instance, in one church history, or this is a medieval history by a secular author, but you can see the same thing in church histories and by Christians. Quote, the barbarian invasions were not a calamity to all dwellers in the empire. It made no difference. In other words, it made no difference to the Christian. It made no difference to the ground-grubbing colonist whether his master was Roman or German, if only he was kindly, end quote. Now, that might be true enough in isolation in a particular circumstance, but there's a reason that a serf remains a serf if he thinks that the Roman or the German made no difference in theology. Their new German lords were Arians, remember. That would have made all the difference in the world for time and for eternity. It would have made a difference if they were not driven out of northern Africa by the Muslims, and it would have made a big difference if the Muslims had won in Byzantine 1,000 years before they did. They would have taken over Europe, and we would, as I said that week, we'd all be wearing lampshades and our women would be wearing burqas. It makes all the difference in the world what's going on out there. Since when have we reduced the peasant to merely what he thinks he is? That's not a Christian idea. What if he thinks he's nothing but primordial slime? Who's going to defend his rights on that basis? And who's going to preach the gospel to him when we are wearing a lampshade? To be sure, what matters to the simple is always a reduction. But this is precisely why the simple will continue to be reduced by the tyrant, except for the triumph of the word. History is never moved by the lowest common denominator, and nobody really believes that it should be, or else they wouldn't think about it to begin with, and they wouldn't write stupid books that say things like that. Let's talk about this Christian doctrine of the individual. And let me draw a circle around the word individual and isolate or leave out of the equation for the moment the ism, because there's a battle over this today. And if you have to look back in church history, at least as part of your study, to see why this is wrong. And it's really in the last 10 years that this is catching on, and it's everywhere. In the past decade of our own time, an exceedingly rapid and comprehensive assault on individualism has occurred within the evangelical church. No doubt modernity has pressed individualism to its breaking point and given us the sovereign self. But can we see a uniquely biblical vision of the individual rising out of the dark ages of paganism that does not necessarily become individualism? The individual becomes an ism. It becomes an end in itself when the whole of reality is reduced to the finite individual person. What matters for the individual, what the individual says as an authority, things like that. But have we not let the abuse of terms
define the terms for us? It's the individual who was made for the glory of God, Genesis 1:26. And it is the individual who falls short of that glory, Romans 3:23. True worship is personal, and so is its opposite. And that takes an individual soul, with his mind, his body, and all. Take away the uniqueness of the individual soul above mere nature, and you take away the beginning and the end, from God to man. And you take away the center, where the individual God-man reconciles the whole. The assault on the individual in contemporary evangelical churches from all quarters, all heresy, all heretics, denying the biblical doctrine of man universally. The assault on the individual in the contemporary evangelical church in America, and especially from missional circles, is nothing less than an assault on the root and branch of the Christian worldview. In addition to being flaming heresy, it's also very, very sloppy history. First of all, no significant Christian thinker can be shown to propose an individualism that eradicates covenantal, relational, moral boundaries between individuals. Such radical individualisms really do come from modernity. The individual is not sovereign, true, but he is responsible, and he ought to be kept so precisely by living free from autocratic rule and from the tyranny of the herd instinct. So often individual, or the Christian individual, or the rational individual, or the individual that transcends nature, is pit against social consciousness, for example. So I won't even put individualism versus collectivism. I'll just put, if you so stress the individual, you will eradicate social consciousness, or biblical social consciousness. But there's a couple things this person's not understanding. And they're everywhere. And they're allowed to write books, unfortunately. The Christian understanding of conscience is not a modern development, owing itself to the superior movements of the soul within the commonwealth. On the contrary, the necessity of a free individual conscience was precisely that priority of worship and its corresponding danger of idolatry. In other words, the value of the individual, the importance of the individual in the Christian worldview is first and foremost because he's made for God. She's made for God. She must worship God, not even wife or husband or community. You can worship God through them, but you cannot have them as your reference point. The freedom of the conscience as a social phenomenon was a logical implication of the biblical understanding of God's glory in the image bearer. But the primary reason that the biblical worldview upholds the independence of the individual from other, not independence from God, not independence from responsibility to others because of God, but the primary reason that the biblical worldview upholds the independence of the individual from other finite individuals is that the soul of each man or woman was made exclusively for God's pleasure, not for other men or women, or the whim of the tyrant, or the winds of the day. Hence, the transcendence of the individual over the collectivity of other finite beings is as necessary for true worship as it is for all of the other benefits that it gives to mankind. The transcendence of the individual over the collective is a paradox to the social consciousness. It's hard to think about at first. At first, the individual unit and the whole do look to be at odds to the animal mind. But by thinking about it, we see that you can't have one without the other. But the Christian tradition would insist that no social consciousness ever arises from a social conscience. Social conscience is a contradiction in terms. It's a confusion of categories. The conscience is not a social thing. With knowledge in the Latin, the conscience is only ever, always an individual thing, like a mind. We're not Hegelians or Easterners. We don't believe in a social, we don't believe that the world is God or that society is the human spirit. That's heresy. That's heresy. That's not a biblical idea. Social consciousness never arises from social conscience. There's no such thing. Only an individual conscience can inform and improve social consciousness. A conscience is only ever an individual. And to eradicate the individual is to eradicate the divine image, which necessarily restrains each individual from mistreating other individuals. Let's look at this in three areas in the Middle Ages and how the Christian doctrine of the individual eradicated or made war against three particular things, or three different movements, maybe not necessarily against some particular evil. First of all, biblical individualism and the abolition of slavery. The modern liberal will insist that slavery didn't go away simply because Christianity said so. And if you say it like that, of course that's true. Like it's a, you know, slavery go away and it poof, it goes away. That's not the point. Or that we were there first or at that time or anything like that. That's not the argument. It declined, they say, in the Middle Ages, purely out of self-interest. And I find that to be a very ironic and laughable objection. I agree with it in part, but I find it fascinating that they're making that argument. They say the kind of labor was no longer viable with new machinery. So what do we make of this criticism? Well, like I said, it's certainly fascinating that the modern collectivist finds one area, at least, where self-interest produces social justice. So you see his argument. Slavery didn't end because of any social consciousness which comes from the Christian worldview. Slavery withered on the vine because of self-interest. He's assuming that self-interest, properly defined, is not a Christian doctrine, number one. And he's also ironically picking this one area where self-interest is actually a good thing, when his whole worldview says that self-interest is never a good thing. It's also interesting that they have to credit the advance of machinery to Christians only in order to deny the advance of freeing slavery to Christians. In other words, they have to choose their poison. It's always a very fun thing to see, to watch the believer in nonsense squirm as they have to choose which detestable thing they have to admit to maintain their other fantasy. So they hate the idea of Christians freeing slaves so much that they have to embrace this other idea that they hate, that Christians were actually smart enough to invent all those things for 1,000 years, which they want to deny out of the other side of their mouth. All ironies aside, we may notice a more straightforward problem with their thesis. They'll say the same about the abolition of slavery in the modern era. In other words, Wilberforce's reforms in Britain to the American movement that culminated in the Civil War. Namely, they say, that the institution was withering on the vine for purely economic reasons. So listen to what they're saying. We're asked to believe that slave labor was rendered unprofitable for the first time, for mechanistic reasons, in the 9th century and in the 19th century. Notice, in their view, a full millennium for the American plantation to reach the conditions of Europe in the Dark Ages. The idea doesn't hold up on a moment's reflection. The whole contemporary debate over the minimum wage is a pretty good example of how it violates even the most basic level of common sense. There'd be no debate over minimum wage if it wasn't more economically profitable to hire people for nothing rather than for something. I could think of tons of things around me. I don't care how much some machine in my backyard made something. My wife will come up with jobs for me to do. I have got 3,000 things that I'd love. If I can make you work for me for nothing, if I could get away with it, I've got lots of things to do. I mean, the argument is just the stupidest thing anybody that's ever had work to do that they don't want to do. Anybody that's ever had that situation understands what a fallacious argument this is. But the facts make a much more interesting and edifying story. There are sociological reasons for it. The first cause in the decline of slavery was the decline of an imperial power in the 4th century. Slaves come from conquest. Doesn't matter who does the conquering, white people, black people, Asian people, for economic reasons, for less economic reasons, out of fear, doesn't matter. When you whoop up on somebody and nobody's there to catch you, you're going to put people to work. That's universal, has nothing to do with Christianity in that sense. Slaves come from conquest. And as conquest waned, so too did the procurement of slaves. Secondly, from the time between Constantine to Justinian, so early 6th century, slavery went from being discouraged to banned, and the full sacraments of the church were administered to slaves from the beginning, which tended to make a statement. Slaves were treated as equals in the transcendent society of the church, and therefore who was anyone in the mundane society, the lower society, to shut them out? As one historian, Pierre Bonacy, said, quote, a slave was baptized and had a soul. He was then unambiguously a man. The church did that. Thirdly, and most importantly, the biblical doctrine of man rendered the position intellectually untenable. Only the uneducated, those who were intellectually enslaved, could ever argue for the position of physical enslavement again. With the Christian doctrine there, slavery could not be intellectually justified with a straight face. Now, that would happen later on, precisely among those who are not being cultivated by the biblical patterns of thought. Secondly, biblical individualism and the rise of capitalism. Notice that biblical individualism destroyed the institution of slavery intellectually. Notice that biblical intellectualism, or individualism, is going to justify and give wings to capitalism. Capitalism was actually on the rise from the fall of Rome. Millions were released from the empire's excessive taxation, and so now there was an incentive for farmers to innovate in their means of production. It took money and time to perfect the water wheel in order to grind grain. For example, the Greeks and Romans realized how water worked and how it could power things, yet the growth of the public sphere in both ancient Greece and Rome disabled mass innovation. They never got around to it because of their philosophy of state, even though their scientists and engineers knew how to do it. England and France each had thousands of such water wheels turning grain into flour in homes all over the rivers by the 10th century. The horseshoe prevented wear and tear on the horse, which was cheaper than the ox. And likewise, now the horse collar allowed horses to be used for similar loads that people had used oxen for, yet without strangling them. These were Christian inventions. They might not seem very exciting at first, but it increased the produce, drove down prices immeasurably. Heavier plows that could dig deeper into heavy soil showed up by the 6th century. Chimneys, eyeglasses, and clocks had instant implications for industry. So cooking, heating, metal melding, metal craft could all now be done indoors on a mass level around the clock. Or in ways that they hadn't been done previously. Likewise, whereas before a large portion of the workforce was out of work early as soon as their sight went, with glasses, their extended life of sight means massive increase in productivity. And now every town in Europe knew what time it was and could coordinate their schedules by it. In Eastern Orthodoxy, they would not put clocks even in their churches and their public buildings because they thought time was a temporal thing as opposed to earth, which was ironic given their view of icons. It was a reversal of the idea. Okay, so your theology determines the innovation. The innovation, in turn, defines and shapes living conditions. But all of these were products of the high Middle Ages, and productivity skyrocketed. You see this everywhere now. Now, Rodney Stark's going to argue against Protestants and the idea of Max Weber and the Protestant work ethic and stuff like that. And he's right in some ways. Capitalism was there from the beginning, but really, his point proves too much. Capitalism, therefore, was a generic thing. It's just the way things work. It's people owning the means of production and using them, exploiting them according to their end, which is the basic nature of the soul that Christianity teaches. So naturally, wherever Christian worldview predominates, you're going to have the rise of ingenuity and work ethic and goals and coordination and stuff like that. So that is not in any way incompatible with the Protestant, the thesis that with the Protestant Reformation this exploded. Before the Protestant Reformation, yes, there were capitalistic explosions, commercial innovations in places like Italy, in those port cities, and then eventually westward in France and in places like that. But they all came to a grinding halt as things ebbed and flowed in culture. So the economy can't exist on its own. It's holistic. It goes together. For example, if you don't have property rights, patent rights, if those contracts are not enforced, in other words, if you don't have the rule of law, an economy can't pop out of a bottle just by unleashing the market. There's no such thing as a free market without the protection of those things in law. That's a Christian idea. And so the Protestant Reformation did revolutionize that and make it more universal. Finally, biblical individualism and the dissolution of totalitarianism. So wait a minute, totalitarianism, that's in the 20th century. Well, the ugliest manifestations of it were, but there were forms of it, there always have been. Long before Christian influence was marshaled against the most modern forms of totalitarianism, there was an original literary assault upon the total claims of either church or state. For example, Dante Alighieri. His dates are 1265 to 1321. Dante, by the way, is heavily influenced by Thomas Aquinas. And perhaps the most famous of these critics at the time, the turn of the 14th century, because of his classic Divine Comedy. That's the Inferno, Purgatorio, Paradiso. You gotta say it in the Latin, otherwise it's not cool. But it's his political work, De Monarchia, on the monarchy in 1318 that's the most hotly debated, at least in its time. Let me give you a chart of two guys I'm going to talk about, Dante and Marsilius of Padua. To show you, a radically different political theory that has implications for church and state. Big picture theology here of church and state. First of all, Dante and his idea of the monarchy. For Dante, the two spheres, church and state, have been ordained with totally different prerogatives. Now, they're both, this is not pietism. It's not a two-kingdom view, in a sense, because all he's saying so far is that they're different spheres. They're separate. And they have been ordained heads. I'll represent the state on the right here with the crown. Should have done the state on the left because, of, you know, in the old creation, new creation, but whatever. And I'll put just a, Bible, because it's the seat of their authority, representing the head in the church. Here I'm talking about physical head, representative, in the only true sense of the word, vicar of Christ, representing him, but not a monarch. Obviously, Christ is the personal monarchical head of the church. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about human agents at this point. So God has directly ordained both the institution and the head of those institutions. That's all Dante has said at this point. The fact that Rome came to rule in both was ordained by God in his providence. Yet their human officers have no such right in perpetuity. Now here's where you're going to see Dante is a bit of a humanist. He's going to be an early critic of Catholicism, but he's got to be very careful at this stage in how he criticizes. These human officers have no right to reign in perpetuity. He anticipates John Wycliffe's doctrine at this point of dominion. He was very careful in his language, however, than others would be, more careful, since he wrote in the era just after Boniface's Unum Sanctum. And he gave his universal power to the Pope. Marsilius of Padua, I'm going to spend a little bit more time on him. He died in 1342. He was the most radical political thinker of his day. He wrote most of a co-authored book, Defensor Pacis, and I've seen that referred to or translated as the Defense of the Faith and the Defense of the Peace. And I haven't figured out which that is yet, but Defensor Pacis. In it, he argues that both political bodies, church and state, are rooted in the value and therefore the will of the people, so each individual. So in Marsilius, and sometimes if you Google him, you'll see Marsiglius. Same guy. So let's draw these same circles. Church and state. I'm not going to draw the same symbols representing heads. Marsilius admits that there are heads, but those are a matter of convenience. What I'm going to draw instead within these spheres is three more arrows flowing down from the sphere to the seat of consent or authority. Where does authority reside? For Marsilius, it resides in the congregation, the ecclesia, the assembly. So this is a radical view for at the turn of the 14th century. God is the ultimate authority, of course, as he has expressed himself in Scripture. And the human authority is there. It's a matter of convenience and intelligibility. As far as the state goes, it proceeds from the family, as the individual and his progeny are prior and foundational for that which it protects. So that's good. He's totally reversing Aristotle's politics, where human beings are essentially a political animal and the state predates the family. Okay? Sorry, one more thing in this chart. I'm going to draw a thick line between these two in Marsilius. And you'll see the relation, you'll start to see a relationship, and you'll see it mostly in a guy named William of Ockham, who we'll talk about, a relationship between nominalism and pietism. That thick wall represents a radical separation. So as far as the state goes, the state is there to protect the image bearers. And I think that's right. And you can show that throughout the Bible. Now, as far as the church goes, the pastor and the bishop and the priest are just synonyms in Scripture. They have no authority except to administer the word. In anticipation of Calvin's doctrine of church power at this point, Marsilius says that the keys of the kingdom are declarative, not judicial. So at this point, Marsilius was at one with the reformers to come. As far as Scripture being the ultimate authority, as far as the word being the authority and the basic essence of what the church he wouldn't say governors, but officers are to do. But here's the problem. This same logic in Marsilius' mind forces him to go beyond itself and starts to reason that if a church assembly is nothing but its individual Christians, which you could say that and be right about it, but in his mind it means something particular. And if a particular state is a Christian state, so remember the family issues forth in the state's only there to protect them. So a state, if it's a Christian state, is just a secular assembly of Christian individuals. So you see where this is going, hopefully. And then the individual who's given the secular sword may, and in fact must, represent the body of believers by calling councils and censuring false teachers. Well, Marsilius, in spite of his best intentions, has just placed the state over the church. And this is exactly what you're going to see any time where pietism divorces the church and the state. It effectively gives the keys of the kingdom to Adolf Hitler and says, well, that doesn't matter. That's not a gospel issue. Okay? But by reasoning that way, the state, if it's a Christian state, well, what the heck does that mean? A Christian state. Now, I want Christians to influence the state and there to be just laws. But a Christian state in the same sense as a Christian is a Christian? Hence, individualism becomes unbiblical when the individual, becoming the starting point, erases the distinction between the church and the state. Marsilius did not grasp that unless the church derives its authority as a sphere, complete with called leaders, directly from God, then the state is actually over and above the church. Your view of church government determines whether or not you'll be wearing a lampshade. Your view of church government will determine. You hook him up to a lie detector test. I have no doubt that he really believes the church. Anabaptists, hook an Anabaptist up to a lie detector test. Don't throw him in the river. Hook him up to a lie detector test. And I believe them. They'll pass the test that they believe the church and the state are two totally different worlds. They want to live in those two different worlds. They're cool with that. That's what they want. I have no doubt that they're sincere about that. You can't have that position consistently in the real world. It doesn't go together in the real world. The church has to talk to the state if it wants the state to not tell them what the Bible means. So you have to have a theology of politics coming from the Bible, and the church has to speak it prophetically. This kind of individualism eradicates all of those buffer zones between the individual and the state. The church instantly is subsumed within the secular sphere at this point. But he clearly did challenge the notion of a central pope altogether. So Marsilius, in a lot of ways, does anticipate Wycliffe and other reformers. Another leading humanist, Petrarch, his dates are 1304 to 1374, he remarked about the new temporary capital of Christendom in France, in Avignon. And Petrarch said this about this new capital. And this could be Luther talking about Rome a couple generations later. He says, "Here reign the successors of the poor fishermen of Galilee. They have quite forgotten their origin. Babylon," that's what he called it, "the home of all vices and misery. There is no piety, no charity, no faith, no reverence, no fear of God, nothing holy, nothing just, nothing sacred. All you have ever heard or read of perfidy, deceit, hardness of pride, shamelessness, and unrestrained debauchery, in short, every example of impiety and evil the world has to show you, are collected here. Here, one loses all good things. First liberty, then successfully repose, happiness, faith, hope, and charity." So he wasn't a big fan of Avignon becoming the new capital, which I will tell you about just in a second. Elsewhere he wrote of this city, not of the papacy itself, he wasn't criticizing the pope. Quote, "It's the fountain of afflictions, the refuge of wrath, the school of errors, the temple of lies, the awful prison, hell on earth." You can't say that about the church today. That's a great line of picturesque criticisms there. But why did he say this to begin with? Well, it got to the point where there were now two ultimate authorities over one Christendom. Whatever had not caused the man on the street to doubt Catholic authority and unity at this point would start to, the rest of it would start to, you know, unravel. The last nail in the coffin was what Rome did to themselves in the 14th century. If anything ought to get the attention of the Roman Catholic in terms of questioning authority, their own authority, it would be the episode of the transfer of the papacy to Avignon in France. It would lead to an event that became known as the Papal Schism. And it all began as a showdown between Boniface VIII and Philip the Fair, who I've mentioned those two. It was a continuation of usual rifts between church and state. But by this time, the state had much more power than the church, as it was growing apart from the church. The Pope issued a bull denying any right of taxation of clergy or church land. When both England and France refused, the Pope conceded. So the Pope's trying to beat his chest and say, don't tax the clergy anymore. England and France tell him to go fly a kite, and he says, all right, good point. Mark that differently. Pretend I didn't say that. And then put a stamp on it and be authoritative. So that was the first victory for the state. But then when the Pope issued his famous Unum Sanctum, now this didn't make him more humble, this made him more arrogant. In 1302, he sends this thing out, Unum Sanctum, this statement that has this unqualified power for the Roman head. But that was the last straw. Philip Schaff, in his church history, summarizes this very well. He says, there was no assertion of authority contained in this bull which had not been made before by Gregory VII and his successors. But in the Unum Sanctum, the arrogance of the papacy finds its most naked and irritating expression. In other words, he had communicated in such a way to say, I'm your God. All that stuff you saw before, we really mean it, and especially because of me. It really had that quality to it. Now, Philip, in spite of his name, the Fair, was as much of a hothead as the Pope. Yet apparently he possessed more ingenuity and more power behind him. After the Pope charged him with heresy and excommunicated him, the Pope offered to Albrecht in Germany the throne of the whole empire. But Albrecht's thinking, what empire? That would have worked a century ago. And Albrecht was wise to refuse that gift. All that Boniface had going for him now was his eloquent boasting. Philip formed an alliance with Boniface's enemies in Italy, the Colonna family, who were driven into exile in France, and they wanted vengeance. And so they got together and hatched a plan to imprison him. It was the ultimate humiliation. The Pope was scheduled to read the pronouncement of his excommunication at his seat in Attigny on September 7th, when a band of 300 men came to drag him off to lions. Now Philip would call his own council, which charged the Pope with heresies and ultimately cultivated more nationalistic sentiment. So again, one more thing Europeans looked at. They captured the Pope. The French have this, their ultimate or superior synod, and all the people in France are saying, wow, you mean we can do that? And it just further increased their esteem for the state and lowered it for the Roman Church. Now, Boniface was released, but shortly after that, just days after that, he died in 1303, and a lot of people believe of insanity. One might say that the first seeds of the Reformation are here rather than in Wycliffe or Huss, but that's a sociological angle. That's the nations moving apart independently, and as they gain independence, they get more and more powerful and develop theologies of their own. And what it amounts to is that by the turn of the 14th century, many people across Europe, not just a handful, many people across Europe saw the Roman bishop as just that, a bishop who had usurped his position over the centuries by a mixture of ambition and convenience, arising out of problems that were unique to the closing centuries of the first millennium but were now irrelevant. So really, even before the Reformation, lots of people throughout Europe saw this as something that was passé, and they just kind of paid the tax, you know, Peter's pence, and dealt with it just for a little while. Boniface II, the handpicked, and now we're going to get from, it's moving to Avignon, to how did the schism happen. His handpicked successor died after only 1 year, and so the cardinals got together and chose a Frenchman, known as Pope Clement V, and he reigned from 1305 to 1314. But Clement gave Philip the man that he needed to run things from afar. And more than any overturning of the policies of Boniface, the king and pope together used political unrest in the papal states as a pretext for moving the see to Avignon, France, in 1309. So, this is going to be a real fast and sloppy map, but you'll get the idea. Here's Italy, there's island, Africa. And so you have Africa here. So here's France, Spain, got to have that tip over there. So here's the Iberian Peninsula, and here's France, here's the rest of Europe, here's England. Boom. So what happened was they moved the papacy from Rome to right here, Avignon, on the banks of the Rhone River, coming out here, is a couple hundred miles south of Paris. And you spell it like this, but if you want to be cool, if you want to finally get, and there's two people I think that listen to this in France, I'm going to get this right. Avignon. Oh, that's right. I got that right. But that's where it moved in 1309. And remember, there's one pope at this point. It was better suited, the city was, to run Europe politically because it possessed more centralized civil structures. There was 30 cardinals who lived there in private palaces of their own. But what it lacked in spiritual heritage, it made up for in pomp, which was all that Rome was about anyway. Rome, by contrast, was declining. It only had 20,000 residents by century's end. So this is a total shift happening here. The first order of business for the king and his new pope in Avignon was to drive out the Templars from France. That monastic order had long been an object of royal jealousy because of their wealth, and especially Philip. Philip wanted their money. That was the bottom line. So by 1310, many of them had been tortured and executed on various trumped-up charges of heresy. Succeeding Clement as pope was the most effective of these French popes, John the 22nd, 1316 to 1334 was his reign. John maintained the prestige of the French spiritual center of gravity by pitting themselves against the Austrian and German usurpers of Italian politics. And so the French pope was saying to Rome, in other words, they're thinking to themselves, they're not going to put up with this for too much longer. They've always had their popes here, and they've always had Italian popes, at least for a while. And so we're going to position ourselves as the champions of the real Roman Empire, namely you guys, too, against these aggressors who've always been at your throat, these Germans. So it was a stroke of brilliance there politically, and it lasted for a little while. But this further cultivated the divide between the South and the German peoples, which you're going to see play out in the Reformation. Even though those around Rome would quickly begin to turn against the Western Sea. So this is what I mean by providence. Here's a bunch of Catholics trying to maintain their Catholic empire. One of the things that does is it further exacerbates something, a wave that Luther just rode on 150 years later. 200 years later. Almost. But it was during this time in the years 1348 to 1349 that the Black Death swept across Europe. And of course we know everything we know about the Black Death from Monty Python. So, it's almost accurate. But it began as a series of large sores with a violent fever and then vomiting out blood. And usually, once the sick person got sick, they would only last for about a day or two. Well over half of the population of all the major cities was wiped out. In the city of Marcellus, I think is how you pronounce this, in that city alone, close to 60,000 people died in a single month. Half of England, 2.5 million, were dead after those 2 years. You have to consider divine judgment here. And of course, the secularists will say, yeah, judge, oh, well not, but it wasn't God. Well, wait a minute, these are the people you want off here. I mean, what, is it too cruel? Okay, so from a Christian perspective, you have a more unified way to approach this as divine judgment. Judgment for what? Well, in general, divine judgment's already the case throughout human history. So said the Apostle Paul in Romans 1:18. So said Jesus in Luke 13. Were these people any worse sinners than them? So it's already generally true. But what about the specific wickedness of medieval Christendom? As long as there's some to go around, there's a pretext for divine judgment, for thinking about it that way. But I mention that only in passing. The Avignon papacy would be up and running until 1377. And this period has been called by Catholics the Babylonian captivity of the church. So that Luther was not the first to apply that title to a post-biblical historical phenomenon. Their excessive taxation and their threats of excommunication to whoever wouldn't pay cemented in the minds of many that Roman Christianity was nothing but a political farce, so that people preferred the possibility of a tyrant at home than the certainty of this singular tyranny who presumed to wield heavenly sanction from far away in Rome. So all this was cementing itself long before Luther's time. The examples of cognitive dissonance in people were legion. It was a popular saying, for example, in the streets of England that, quote, the Pope is French, but Jesus Christ is English. These are the same guys that made all the Jesus movies a couple centuries later, because he's always British. But it shows you there that, you know, you're willing to say the Pope is French, but Jesus is English. Well, if you're going to go that far about Jesus, or that far about Englishness, why not just take the whole thing to yourself? And that's what eventually did happen. But for now, they lived with this cognitive dissonance. When both sides of that equation are held to with jealousy, one wonders what element of the Christian faith is driving that motive. At the turn of the 14th century, when the man on the street thought of the church, he tended to think of a financial and not of a spiritual relationship. When he thought of the clergy, he thought of something more like the IRS. Urban V, his reign was 1362 to 1370, returned the papacy to Rome in 1367, only to have it returned in the year of his death to Avignon. Then it was moved back to Rome in 1377 by Gregory XI, which then saw his sudden death the next year, and so naturally the violent debate began between the French and the Italian higher-ups. So Urban VI was elected, but immediately fell out of favor with even the Roman cardinals, so that everyone agreed that the election was illegitimate after just a few months. Another interesting chapter. They all agreed that the election was illegitimate. A Genevan, Clement VII, was elected, so they hadn't deposed him. They were a little embarrassed. They had put this guy up there and said that it was illegitimate, but they did it. So they just put in another guy, Clement VII. He was elected and immediately moved it right back to Avignon by the end of 1378. But here's the problem. Now, there's two popes. It wasn't the first time it happened, but it was the first time that one college of cardinals had created the two-headed monster. Or was it two monsters with one head? In 1394, the University of Paris attempted to step in and make peace and recommended that both popes abdicate. A new vote could then be held by all of the surviving members of the 1378 college. And then, where their numbers were failing, you could get an equal union of representatives from both sides, the Italian and the French side. Of course, the Avignon Pope, Clement VII, wasn't very fond of the idea. He thought he was pretty legitimate, and he threatened the faculty to keep its nose in its books and out of the heavens. So who would decide between these heads? A third head? That's what Paris was acting as at the time. Clearly not. So what did the various nations do? They interpreted the Pope, who was in turn interpreting the Bible, according to their own political consciences. So they really did have an evangelical doctrine of Scripture. It was just secular. Everyone in northern and central Italy held their Pope to be the genuine article. Everyone else looked to Avignon. But since no one but the French really liked looking to France, they looked with their fingers crossed behind their backs. With two papacies to prop up, taxes were raised even more. And this only led to further abuse. These two lines of popes went on for 27 years until 1415. And so to make matters worse, in 1409, a third line emerged from a council in Pisa, which deposed the other two. So these cardinals emerged from that plan back in Paris, a generation earlier, to make peace. And so these guys were still alive, and they met at Pisa, which is probably why the tower started to lean. They're looking at this debacle unfold. But in an attempt to make unity, the third faction was created. That's another criticism of Roman Catholicism. You know, in the name of doing things with purity, you're dividing the body. Well, in the name of unity, you're dividing the body. Don't you love it when churches that divide and form a new church are called, like, the Church of Unity? You ever hear that story? It's true. Not the true story. But it was true here, because these guys originally organized in Paris to make unity. By the time they get to Pisa, they just have a third pope. Here's a list of the three lines. The Roman line, from 1378 on, Urban VI, Boniface IX, Innocent XII, Gregory XII. He was then deposed at Pisa in 1409. The Avignon line, Clement VII, Benedict XIII, he was deposed at Pisa in 1409. So notice that the Roman and the Avignon line are deposed at Pisa, but there had to be another council. Let me write those on the board. 1409. These are conciliatory, I guess you could say, councils. I think they were called reformatory councils. Schaff especially speaks well of the Council of Constance, not because he agrees with all of it, because it clarifies things for the Reformation. In fact, it was at Constance that Jan Hus was condemned. When the heck was that third one? It was in Basel, I think in the 1430s. Let me get the exact date right over here. Where did I put it? 1431. Which it doesn't factor as much in, but Pisa and Constance do. So, in other words, when they deposed these two other lines, there still had to be action taken. They didn't necessarily respond to that. So there had to be a third line, the Pisan line, that existed until 1417, when Martin V was put on there after Constance and people finally said, okay, we need one Christendom. And so Martin V was acknowledged by the whole Catholic Church. But for a while there, for a decade, there was three popes. Well, how was it that the Roman center won out in the permanent Catholic mindset? The answer is the same as the Catholic final answer to everything else. Tradition. As Paul Johnson summarized it, the popes in Rome were a metaphysical fact on top of everything else. In Avignon, they were simply an institution. In 1300, 20,000 people had come to Rome for the Jubilee. Christians didn't come to Avignon except on business. So the other thing that must be said about the ascent to secular power that Boniface and his whole line represented is that the dissatisfaction with the church's role in prayer and the ministry of the word is really a gripe and a grumble against God himself. When the French apologist for Louis IX, prior to Philip, had sent a letter back leaving the Pope, delegating the crumbs on the table, leaving the Pope with merely the forgiveness of sins, prayer, and preaching, to not be content with this is to fail to believe Scripture about what the Holy Spirit claims about its power. To say imperial church is nothing other than to declare that church is the unbelieving church. Beyond that, the devil's counterfeit is meant to discredit the genuine article. Here's another thing that was happening at this time. There's always these co-opting of true things in their worst form, and so the idea gets discredited with the man. When Boniface elevated the priest above the magistrate, elevated the pope above the sword, the two swords, his critics conceived then to blame the doctrine of the church as a whole. In fact, the office of the church, biblically, is over the office of the state as a prophet with the word, not as a king with the sword or from their own will. The pendulum would swing, after Boniface, from triumphalism to pietism. From the church holding its sword of steel to the neck of the state, to the church dropping its spiritual sword altogether and holding out its own neck to any sword that's willing to strike. But the bride of Christ is no more charged with suicide than with prostitution. If you're worried that the bride of Christ is being a prostitute with the sword of the state, you don't solve that problem by having the church commit suicide with the sword of the state. Pietism. So I mentioned these three councils, which I already did, but here's the interesting thing about Pisa. These are reformatory or conciliatory councils, and what emerged was a conciliatory theory, which apparently the spell checker does not accept as a word. It's at war with me, but it's a word. The conciliatory theory had to do with the relationship between councils and popes, and this is very interesting for authority and for church unity. If the thinking launched at Pisa, so in other words, Pisa that came up with that third line, the whole idea was peace, but in so doing, and here's the reason why they wouldn't go for it, this is coming from these guys at Paris, not clergy. That would have immediately erased the distinction between clergy and laity. In a sense, what? Put the university over the church? But these guys get together a generation later under the auspices of cardinals who are then, what? Naming the pope? That would put the councils over the popes. So you have a whole something closer to reformed doctrine of the church, reformed doctrine of the word, reformed doctrine of the authority of scripture, authority, you know, where does authority lie? Some of these questions almost were eked out before that, if the thinking that was launched at Pisa had won the day. They did get their pope, but that was a matter of politics. Their theology did not win. If that thinking of council over pope had won the day, then church councils would take precedent over virtually any statement of the popes. And at the end of the day, it did not win, at least in Catholic theology. Constance, as I said, was helpful. It was ecumenical and authoritative for Rome, and in placing the pope back on a seat of authority, and its condemnation of John Huss. That's all bad stuff, but it clarified what would be at stake in the century to come. Finally, wow, nationalism, nominalism. Can I even go here? I will. I'm going to do the 10-minute version, and then we'll wrap it up. Two phenomena. One political, the other philosophical. I'm going to leave that up there because this pretty much, I'm going to erase the map, and I'm going to erase those three councils. I'm going to leave that on the board. Actually, I won't need that. I'll just do it over here. Nationalism, nominalism. What on earth? One's a political theory, one's a philosophical theory. What do they have to do with each other? Well, on the one hand, you have the old tribal mixtures of Rome's disintegration forming now into distinct political entities. And, at the same time, you have the classical intellectual project of articulating the essence of the real world. Remember, realism. articulating ultimate things. These things beginning to move in opposite directions, like a fire going out underneath a cauldron where its heat had already mixed a new complex mixture. And so what's going on here is you have the rise of nations, different nation states. Let's just put three to represent the English, the French, and the German. But underneath that, within the mind, you have the real foundation disintegrating. So it wasn't just the Catholic synthesis. So, for example, in authors as diverse as G.K. Chesterton, John Henry Newman, historians like Paul Johnson, Russell Kirk, all Catholics or people that had converted to Catholicism from Anglicanism, you have this lamenting about the loss of the medieval synthesis. But what they mean by that, so they can't disassociate realism from Rome. And it works to effect, I personally think the devil's behind it, because the evangelicals can't disassociate those two. Not only do evangelicals confuse realism with Plato, they confuse realism with Rome. And so the disillusion of this synthesis, evangelicals should mean the medieval or the Christian idea, which the medieval world, imperfectly, but nevertheless, stumbled upon. The Roman Catholic, naturally, and the evangelical on the other side of the debate, is going to see that as a function of their physical hierarchy and their ability to create this from up top, meaning, really, ground floor, arising from physical, geographical entities. So, nationalism first, real quickly on that. The origins of nationalism. Before understanding this ism, it's necessary to spell out what we mean by a nation to begin with. In this modern sense, nations didn't exist before that. A nation is a geographical, political entity with clearly defined borders and a central city from which the civil government operates. It is not, in other words, nationalism actually prevents war. No, it doesn't. It causes war. Have you ever read a historical textbook? There's always been war. But what national borders do is it says to everybody else, hey, don't step on my stuff, or I'll shoot you. It's just another way to say it, like property rights, except it's the communal. Clearly defined, more clearer borders than you had before. That's not all it is, but everything else it is produces the same effect. Now, I know, it also is the occasion for more war, but the source of that war is the evil in the human heart, not the clarity of your borders and intentions and your conversations with each other about that. Now, this idea of a nation state with defined borders and a central city from which the civil government operates is not unrelated to ethnicity. A people group is easier to govern and its civil structures will endure longer to the extent that its culture, its foundational ideas are unified. So a state that actually wants to survive and do things justly and live on for a while is going to be very interested in maintaining a singular culture, as opposed to a group that wants to disintegrate that and merge together the interests of transnational interests will want to diffuse that culture. Translation, if that's ever happening, that's the motive. That immediately changes a lot of different political debates today. It's not just the church, but also the state that was splintering the political factions, based on ethnicities, which we've seen were a hodgepodge of barbarian invasions and migrations throughout the centuries after the fall of Rome. Edward I took advantage of this, and it shaped the religion. He threatened all the clergy in England in 1294. If they would not give him half of all that they collected in taxes for his war against France, then they would be expelled. However particular individuals may have conceived of this, the activity would set the church agenda to take sides in international politics. In other words, a uniquely English Christianity was forming, a uniquely French Christianity, less so because it was Catholic. But you notice where it's less Catholic, there's a uniquely national flavor. You say, well, that's just as bad. I understand that. But God's using that at this time. Nationalism rising, realism declining, were like two fault lines converging and leaving church history with a radically different terrain than it had inherited from previous centuries. So here's what's going on. Here's the card trick that who's even big enough to play? Only the devil. God doesn't mean it's for bad. He means it for good. But something evil's happening here. Rome's disintegrating. Yay. Realism's disintegrating. Not good. Evangelical looks back at this and just says, yay. They don't know why they agree with this. They have no idea what this is. But they just see one with the other, and they can't make head or tail out of it. William of Ockham, his dates are 1288 to 1348. He's the one that came up with Ockham's razor, which, by the way, isn't always true. And in fact, as C.S. Lewis said, reality is not simple. If you're asking for something simple, you're asking for the wrong thing when you're talking about reality. But anyway, it's okay as a principle in science if you restrict it. Anyway, William of Ockham, he's interesting because his thought affects both of these thought lines, the nationalistic and the nominalistic. Following Dante and others, William argued that the church and the state are independent of each other, both being designed by God. But in William's thought, we see the seeds of pietism. And William of Ockham was the main guy studied by Luther at law school. And here we're going to notice a straight line from nominalism in philosophy to pietism in religion. When things and their predicates are merely particulars, because particulars, namely universals, are not real, but are merely names we give to them, then this has little to no, if you're consistent, no relation to this. In other words, nominalism leads directly to pietism. If you're a consistent nominalist, things don't have anything to do with other things. You know, things like church and state, or me and art, or me and you, or us and God, as He really is over all of us as a unity. There's a straight line from nominalism in philosophy to pietism in religion. If N.T. Wright wants to learn something, memo, this is free to N.T. Wright. This is why individualism as an ism, with all of its bad effects, exists in modern evangelicalism. Not because of the gospel that was believed by the Reformers, but because of the bad philosophy that was inherited from by the Reformers. Since meaning in nominalism is held strictly in particulars, the names of their predicates are sealed off from anything overarching. So the church and the state are both particulars, with nothing overarching calling them both to any one task. It's why evangelicals today in the 19th century absolutely inflated this and pumped it like a drug into the system on the frontiers of the Second Great Awakening. We'll get to that in church history too. But this is what's happening here. Nominalism, in all of its forms, is separating, fracturing reality into fractured pieces. As Schaeffer called it, bits and pieces thinking that we've settled into. This is as early as the Reformed era and before it, the loss of realism. Luther would inherit this unbiblical sub-Western error, and so too with the majority of the Reformed tradition. It would become, in our day, the chief wedge of criticism by the emerging church against the Reformed tradition. Yet since the critic of the Reformed and the Reformed that they criticize have both swallowed this Kool-Aid, they've swallowed nothing but this very nominalism in their infancy. Their debates with each other stay below the radar screen of the universal root of their real differences. You can't have real differences if you don't have a real unity by which to criticize those differences. Both William and Marsilius were protected by the Bavarian monarch Louis. This relationship between the national protector and the Christian scholar was becoming more normal. Luther would have that from Frederick the Wise. Coming from the generation prior to William, the Scottish theologian of subtlety, as he was known, as the Doctor of Subtlety, John Scotus Duns, his dates are 1265 to 1308, so I'm doing him after to show you what was being gained and what was being lost. Duns represented the last-ditch effort to save realism and to save the medieval synthesis. Unfortunately for the realist doctrine, Scotus Duns argued on its behalf by virtue of the univocity of being. Now that is not a univocal as opposed to analogical. Thomas really, in his theory of analogy, which is the only thing that secular modernists still retain from Thomas, that things are in relation to thing or being an analogy. They're not equivocal, in other words, equivocal which is weird the way it's said like that, because usually it would be equal. But anyway, equivocal would be when you equivocate, your meaning changes from one moment to another, one term to another, or the same term from one moment to another. So things are not equivocal to other things. Our words are not equivocal to the things they attempt to represent, but neither are they univocal. The same things, the same sense. When I say God, G-O-D, with those syllables, with all that I have in my mind, I fall so short of what God is in himself, it ain't even funny. But it represents something of him, because if it could represent nothing of him, then no statement or even criticism along those lines would be anything more than equivocal as well. So Thomas fashioned this doctrine of analogy. Well, John Scotus Duns was working on this idea of the univocity of being. And essentially, to hold that beings are univocal to each other means that they are not analogies, and therefore one must conclude not distinct from each other in any discernible sense. Yet for Scotus Duns, there was being in general, which is the true subject matter of metaphysics, and only then a finer division of beings. Universals come first, so in this sense he was right. Universals come first, not only in being logically antecedent, but also in experience. So in other words, he would say that we actually run into the existence of something before its essence, and that's obviously not true, in a sense. And Aquinas was saying the exact opposite. And so there was a debate here at a school called the Scotist, I think is what they called it, school, which wasn't exactly the same thing as the realist school. It was just one class. So some of his distinctions with Thomas are actually worth looking at. I'm not going to comment on them much here. I think they're worth a whole other study. But and he shot himself in the foot in other ways, especially among evangelicals later on. He argues for the Immaculate Conception of Mary. He tried to actually defend the indefensible Boniface VIII. By the era of the Reformation, here's what's important about him, his followers became known as dunces. Yeah. And the distinction between Scotism and Scholasticism was largely lost. In other words, when Luther studied, he studied a lot of his philosophy in Aristotle from a guy named Nicholas of Cusa, or at least the writer of his day that was filtering down through the law school. And when he understood realism, he understood it through the lens of John Scotus Duns, not primarily Aquinas, though he still criticized Aquinas, and through Aquinas, called Aristotle that great pagan whore, affectionately. That's what he called it. And so because any natural theologizing, Luther had a particular point in mind there, and he didn't mind exaggerating it. But he understood natural theology largely through the lens of Duns, as he was called. William of Ockham, in other words, was declared the winner in a public relations battle, not a careful philosophical inquiry. And nominalism was tacitly embraced and then assumed, and then in the next generation applied uncritically in all areas of life. But that's not to say there were no more realists in the 14th century or by the end of it. In England especially, it was still defended, partially because of the logical structure of the language in full bloom. We'll see this last point. We'll see this in Wycliffe next week. He was a realist, and others at Oxford were as well. But I think part of that was the structure of the English language. The structure of the English sentence, my kids don't understand when I say English is harder to learn than the other languages. What are you talking about? I know you speak English. Yes, that's because you speak English. But it's actually harder to, it's a more logical language, therefore it's more rigorous, and in a sense, in a narrative sense, a flowing sense, less natural. But the structure of an English sentence flows like set logic. It has the effect of reflecting the mind who uses these sentences to a being in the form of a subject of a sentence. And its predicates, which is everything else. In other words, English sentences are like metaphysical trains with an engine and a caboose right where you'd expect it because we know English. But in other languages, the order doesn't matter as much, which doesn't necessarily make you less logical, but the language is less of a mirror of set logic. Then there's this other guy. This guy dies of the Black Death. That's boring. He's not important anyway, but he's one of the guys at Oxford, a guy named Thomas Bradwardine, and he was a bit of a scholastic and a realist. So England, they're still producing these guys, and we'll see at Wycliffe next week how his realism informed a lot of his early precursors to different Reformed doctrines. So, mixed bag here.